This is Metal Mike, and in this episode of the 80s Glam Metal Cast, we talk to a kick-ass vocalist, David Reese. He has an amazing new album out called Cacophony of Souls, and we talk about that in depth. We also revisit his days in Accept, and we talk about all the other bands and projects he's been involved with over the years. Check it out.
David, welcome to the 80s Glam Metal Cast. How you doing today, brother?
Greetings, everyone. Doing fine. Greetings from Piacenza, Italy.
How's everything going?
Quarantine madness.
I was just going to ask how everything's going over there. You staying safe and healthy?
Yeah, so far, so good. They're talking about maybe lifting the ban on the 4th of May, which I don't believe, because this will be like the second or third time they've had a ban lift. So I'm not too optimistic about it, I hope, but we'll see. But it seems that the illness is starting to die down a little bit.
That's definitely good to hear. Well, let's talk about some positive stuff here, some music. So your new album, Cacophony of Souls, has been released. What do you want to tell everybody about it?
Well, it's my third solo album. Fourth. I've actually decided over the years that being a solo artist is far more productive. I'm more in control of what I want to do, and it just seems to be the right course for me to go. I recorded the album last year, beginning in early 2019, with Andy Susamiel and Malte Fredrik-Burk at the bassist. And then we did about 8 or 9 shows and kind of, you know, tried some of the tunes out, like Blood in Our Hands and Metal Voice. We tried live, which went over really well. And then we went into vocal production, I think, end of August into about the first 10 days of September, and I was done. So it was released March 13th, 2020, on El Porto Records, and it's done really, really well. The media has been fantastic. It's the best press I've ever had in response on an album, to be honest.
Yeah, I've been listening to it. I think it sounds killer. I mean, the first point I want to make is your voice is just in top form. Are you blessed or what?
I always like to share this. I'm about 2 years sober. I gave up alcohol. I think that's been a benefit. Also, I've had a lot of vocal training, and a singer's best friend is rest, sleeping. So I try to get about 8 hours of sleep, even when touring, if it's possible. Take good care of my body, and because that instrument is connected. It's not like a guitar, you know, where you just put it on and hopefully your hands are okay. But I'm lucky. I try to take good care of it. I sing pretty much every day to keep the muscle and, you know, warm. So
awesome. Well, you know, one thing is having a great voice, but you got to have well-written melodic tunes, man. And this has it. Very heavy and well-written. A couple of the ones that stood out in my mind were Chasing the Shadows, Blood on Our Hands. Of course, Metal Voice. You mentioned that one. That's awesome. And the title track. Just so many cool songs on there, man. Very, very good stuff.
Thank you. I can't take all the credit. Chasing the Shadows, I actually wrote that song with Andy Susamiel, our guitar player, about 10 years ago. And we had a real knucklehead record company at the time. It was going to be on the album. It was for Universal Language, actually. And they put it on the running order, but didn't put it on the CD. I mean, Andy about lost his mind. It was one of the best songs on the album. So when we set the template to work together again and what direction we wanted to go, he brought up, he goes, hey, we've got to re-release Chasing the Shadows, and let's re-record it and modernize it. And then Blood in Our Hands, we kind of wrote that, like I said earlier, you know, as kind of a test the waters on the new material, because I had released Resilient Heart and was still touring that record because the two guitar players quit. And then I called Andy back to come work with me, and he had finished up the rest of last year's shows. So we tried Blood in Our Hands, and then Metal Voice. It was kind of a fluke how it happened. You know, we had the riff and the idea, and he just said, raise your metal voice. And I said, you know, there's a show called The Metal Voice. And he's like, yeah. And I go, is that what you were thinking? He goes, no, it just came in my head. And then I put the hey part in there. And Cacophony of Souls, the title track, was actually, I wrote that with Martin Frank. I'd written a few other songs with him before that went on Resilient Heart, Karma, Two Coins and a Dead Man, and a song called Heart of Stone. And that song, Cacophony of Souls, I had the riff kind of laid out on demo from him, and I'd written the lyrics while I was in Montana. I have a day job, actually, that I have to work to survive. And I was in Montana again working, and the lyrics just kind of set right on top of that track, but they didn't make the cut for Resilient Heart. Number one, it didn't have a solo section, so I handed it over to Andy, and he composed that great guitar solo part. But like you said, the album is just chock full of melody and his great, brilliant guitar playing. I mean, he's guitar players, you know, if you listen to Andy, you hear a lot of Shanker, Gary Moore, but there's one thing that he stands alone. He's got his own technique and his own style. So that we've done probably four or five albums together in the past. So it was just the right thing to do, get back with Andy. He's such a great, talented guy. He produced, mixed, and arranged the record too, I have to say. I mean, he did an amazing job.
One thing that my ears hear a little bit is a Judas Priest influence. Do you guys like Priest?
I do. I'm a huge fan of Rob Halford. And actually, I did the UDO tour last February and March, the Steel Factory tour. And, you know, during a lot of those hours of traveling, I had purchased Firepower. And what I really liked about that album was it seemed that Judas Priest had kind of gone back to the basic recipe. Even with the layout, you know, the artwork on the cover reminded me of Screaming for Vengeance.
Yep.
And I spent a lot of time just listening to the album while I was driving with the guys. And then, obviously, opening for Udo, you know, I was playing a lot of my songs from Eat the Heat, from Accept that I did. And then the heavier songs from Resilient Heart, like Perfect Apocalypse and Live Before You Die. And I noticed that the audience would really respond to that. And then I would go to the merchandise booth, and a lot of people would ask me, you know, can you get back into this heavier thing? And I'm like, you know what? I better listen to the people. So I kind of just, yeah. There's the Priest influence, like Blood on Her Hands, Chasing the Shadows. And I'm not ashamed to admit, I think Rob Halford is probably one of the greatest metal singers that walked the planet. So, yeah, I'm proud to be compared to that.
Yeah, no, for sure, man. So one thing I got to admit is that I've never been a huge, huge Accept fan. Now, here's where we cut in some booze or something. But I really like Eat the Heat. You got some favorite tracks from your work with them?
I do. Ecstasy, obviously, was a big favorite and a great live song. We still play live to this day. D-Train is another one of my favorites. And Generation Clash is also a great song live. I mean, you get the audience, they know immediately when the bass kicks in what's going on. They all sing the chorus. Hellhammer is a personal favorite. The ballad Mistreated is, I've tried that live a few times. That's a challenging vocal song. It's not easy to play live, so we kind of pulled that out of the set. Has a lot of keyboard arrangements and stuff in it. So, but yeah, I would say those are probably pretty much my favorites from the album. Sad thing about Eat the Heat is that, you know, I think except we should have changed the name of the band. I understand the branding thing, but it was such a different course of action for the band, changing singers. One thing I will say, though, if you go back in the discography of Accept, leading up to Eat the Heat, you had Russian Roulette and Metal Heart. And if you listen to songs like Aiming High, Screaming for a Love Bite, they were kind of leaning in that commercial vein. So the record company's like, we got to get an American singer, you know, a young guy that can, you know, pull it off stateside, because they never really broke in America. And they were always huge over here in Europe. So that was the whole, you know, battle plan, and it kind of failed. But when I look back on it, hindsight, had we changed the name, maybe the album would have been more successful. I'm not sure.
It's tough, you know. You never know. I like to play those kind of games too, especially like on my Twitter page. We'll do a lot of what ifs, but as we all know, there's no going back. But one thing, yeah, you mentioned all the ones that are my favorites. Probably my favorite is Hellhammer. But I like Stand for What You Are too. I think that's a really cool track.
Yeah, that was kind of one that came in while we were writing the album, and I played, you know, harmonica in the intro of it, and it was basically just a positive message song, you know, and it was geared towards the American market. But the funny thing about Eat the Heat, it was released in, I think, 88 or 89. You know, a lot of people either loved me or hated me when that album came out. There was no middle. And when I did the UDO tour and other tours prior to that, people come up to me with that vinyl or that cassette or that CD and say, you know, I hated this, but now I have to say it's one of my favorite Accept albums. I love it. Would you sign it for me? And it's for an album to be 30 plus years old and people tell you that, it left an impression, you know, and not many records do that. I have a few in my life, you know, from when I was a kid that I still listen to, but it's very humbling, you know. I mean, I took a lot of flack for that record, you know, and I was right. fired from the band, and you know, they brought Udo back, and it wasn't an easy time in my life. I wouldn't be talking to you if it wasn't for that album. I mean, that album right. put me on the map.
So we kind of touched on replacing somebody like Udo was not an easy task. And then when you saw similar scenarios, so we saw this happen with Motley Crue, Priest, Maiden. Did you sympathize with some of those replacement singers in those scenarios?
Absolutely. I'm friends with John Corabi. I know, you know, when he joined the band, they gave him $1 million check. I mean, he was the new guy, but, you know, they were playing for 3,000 people on that tour, and it did not commercially go over. And of course, I'll back up a bit. While I was recording Eat the Heat, we were about halfway done with the album vocally, and Dieter Dierks, the producer, was sitting in the big control chair, and he stopped recording and he looked at me and he goes, "You realize if this album fails, it's your fault and my fault." And as a cocky 28-year-old kid, I said, "No, this is going to be the biggest thing ever." And he goes, "No, if it fails, be prepared. You'll be blamed and so will I. It's going to be our fault." So what fans tend to do is, you know, you break their thing, you know, that they grew up with, and the change is so drastic, they blame the singer like it's his fault. And one thing that has to be made clear is Motley Crue, you know, they hired John Corabi. Iron Maiden, Bruce left, and Blaze was hired by Iron Maiden. They didn't force themselves on the band. They were chosen. So it's basically the band's responsibility. And a lot of bands will run away from that part of their history because they made a mistake, you know, let's say commercially and financially. But yeah, when you're a singer that has to put your feet in those shoes, especially a guy like Udo, you cannot do it. I don't care who's singing for the band now. It's not Udo. And I've toured with Udo, and I see him play those classics, and I watch the fans. It's their boy, you know. Yep. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, to replace someone who's been around for years, and especially if they had huge commercial success prior to that.
A couple thoughts are running through my head. So one, when we talk, we'll just get back to John Corabi and Motley Crue. I think the album that he sings on is looked at almost the same way Eat the Heat is. It was a pretty big commercial flop in 1994, but man, that album has also picked up a lot of steam. A lot of people online regard that as the Crue's best album now, so it's crazy.
Oh, musically, it's great. I mean, John, I mean, we were doing shows with The Scream when I was in Bangalore Choir, mm-hmm. and a couple of gigs we did. I remember I saw Tommy in the audience watching Scream, and then one night we did a gig and Nikki was there. So you kind of started wondering what's going on, you know. And I heard they were following, you know, The Scream around and hanging out with Corabi, and something was cooking. But yeah, I mean, when an album has legs and continues to walk, you know, it may not hit it right off. I mean, the stuff that Ripper Owens did with Priest, I mean, the same thing. I'm hearing, why don't you add some of those songs to the set,
yep.
you know, with Priest. And Halford's totally for it. I think they actually do a few songs, and they have a mutual respect for each other. Halford never badmouthed them. Udo never badmouthed me. But, you know, the Motley Crue thing's a little bit differently. You know, it's like Corabi, you know, he's struggled through those years, and I feel for the guy. I mean, yeah. He's a great singer. No doubt about it.
All right, well, let's play a what-if scenario. Let's say Eat the Heat album is just as it is, but with Udo singing, do you think it's really going to have, would have been a big album? What do you think would have happened?
Well, they re-released Ecstasy and Generation Clash with him on it, mm-hmm. and it didn't work. He played Ecstasy live, the solo. He dropped it from his set, and when I was opening from him, one night he actually walked up to me and said, "You're playing it wrong." I said, "Playing what wrong?" "Ecstasy." I said, "Oh, really? I will come out and show you how to do it." I said, "Challenge accepted." But he had at the time had a really bad infection in his leg, a bone infection. So he was really resting up. I mean, the guy did the tour like a champ. But I was hoping he'd come out and share the stage with me on that tour, but he didn't. His son came out, Sven, and played drums one night in Sweden with that song. But I don't think so. I don't think it would have worked. I can't hear Udo singing Prisoner or Stand for What You Are.
Right.
But I can't hear myself singing Restless and Wild and, you know, Fast as a Shark like that guy. He's a German tank.
Now, for me, I got into music in 1986. Vince Neil, David Lee Roth, Paul Stanley, those are the guys that I was getting into musically, you know, when I was coming up. And for me, I didn't get Udo. You know, I didn't get the look and I didn't get the voice. I have a bigger appreciation for it now. But is that kind of where the break and his firing came from? Were they looking to try to get that audience?
Yeah, they were looking at, you know, like I said, Balls to the Wall did about 400,000 copies, just under gold. And I think Metal Heart did about the same. And the record companies were like, hey, man, you know, we got to start hitting gold here. This is going to be over. You know, we're not interested. We got to break a million seller. In those days, you didn't do a million, you were finished. So the whole concept was, let's get an American guy or an English guy, blonde-haired, kind of David Lee Roth front Motley Crue thing, switch gears a little bit, keep the heavy riffs, commercialize it a bit, and break that U.S. audience. It failed miserably. Now, what I can tell you why Udo works, Udo is one of them. I asked the manager at the time, why is he so popular? And she looked me in the eyes and said, because he's one of them. He's metal. You know, he's the working class steel factory German guy who walks out and does his thing his way, always done it his way, and he's been loyal to his fans from day one. And he's in Germany especially, when they're behind you, they'll die with you. And that's the kind of fan base that Udo has. Even in America, the accept fans are that way. You know, wait a minute, this is too bizarre. They've gone commercial, they've sold out. And like with Motley Crue, they went from Home Sweet Home and so Dr. Feelgood to Hooligan's Holiday. And of course, at that time, you had the grunge movement kicking in. Nobody knew their ass from a hole in the ground where they were going musically, including myself. So it was a whole weird thing. And I think what works now for bands like Motley and you know, Def Leppard, it's nostalgia. You know, you came up on those songs.
Yep.
When you see Van Halen, you want to hear Panama and Jump, or, you know, you want to see David Lee Roth do Double Eagles, you know, and kicking off of the drum riser and, you know, talking to the crowd. I mean, that magic, it's indelible. It sticks in your soul. You know what I mean? Those were magic times, you know, in my opinion. I mean, I remember those days well. I mean, those unbelievable times for rock and roll.
Oh, yeah, man. It'll probably never be replicated. On the tour for Eat the Heat, you guys played with Wasp, right? How'd that go?
Yep. Yep. Well, in all honesty, we went out and did about a 31-day club tour as a warm-up. We played every night. And then one thing about Accept, that's a working machine. You know, mm-hmm. When I got into rock and roll, we played five nights a week, six nights a week, four sets a show a night, and we did covers and tried to write songs. And when I joined Accept, I mean, I was in 8 and 10 hour a day rehearsals, and we had A, B, and C set lists. We didn't have a written out set list. You know, they'd call which set we were going to play, and you did it. It taught me the work ethic that the Germans are really good at. But the album didn't take off as great as we thought it would. You know, we had a bullet at about 112 in the top 200, and Generation Clash was getting on the Hard 30 and with Ricky Rackman and those guys, you know, and MTV, and was kind of moving. And then I noticed after the club tour when we jumped on with Wasp, Metal Church was the opening band. We would go from really large venues in the beginning. We started off in San Antonio at the Sunken Gardens, about 30,000 people. And by the middle of the tour, we were playing for 800 to 1,000. You know, I mean, the promoters were selling the shows because they weren't selling tickets. Wasp was suffering, Accept was suffering, but Metal Church were blowing us off the stage. They had a pretty strong following. They were a new young band, you know. But I got fired on that tour. That's when it all came to a head. I mean, in Chicago, that was the end of it for me.
So after Accept, you get you start Bangalore Choir. It's a pretty cool commercial hard rock album, but at that point it was 92, right? Times were kind of against you, weren't they?
I was 90.
90, okay.
I think the Gulf War had just kicked in. We were doing production. Timing, of course. I had momentum. People knew who I was. So I went out to L.A., and I did 9 shows in 1 year. And after those 9 shows, I had an offer from every major label. I had signed up with Howard Kaufman, who managed Stevie Nicks and Whitesnake for management. I had the whole power team behind me, and they brought me to Warner Brothers Giant Record, signed with Warner Brothers. But the tide was changing, and we had a hit single with Loaded Gun. Incidentally, anybody that watches that video, that young male actor, that's Jared Leto. That was one of
really?
His first
actors.
Yeah, that's Jared Leto. Watch it again. You'll be shocked.
I'm going to.
I learned that later in life. I had a girlfriend who said, "You realize who that is?" And I'm like, "No." She said, "That's Jared Leto, the actor." And I looked again. I'm like, "God." So I went to see 30 Seconds of Mars, and I reminded him of it. And he was like, "Oh, my God, that was one of my first acting jobs."
Oh, that's awesome.
Long story short, we got, I think we were scheduled to go out and do Slip of the Tongue opening for Whitesnake.
Ooh,
but
yeah,
with the grunge movement. Literally about 3 months after the album was released, they dropped us. So, I mean, I'm walking around L.A. I'm on top of the world. And then I didn't even know how to get arrested. I mean, it was a really dark time.
Yeah, I mean, and I've heard this story from everybody. It's like, you know, everything's going yeah. great and every, you know, we're on top of the world. And then everything starts to change. What did you do during that time frame? You had some other bands, didn't you?
Yeah, I formed a band with Greg Chase on. I'd actually gone over and rehearsed with Badlands because Badlands and Bangalore had done some gigs together. And Greg and Ray, the singer, would watch me play and always compliment me, and we got to be pretty good friends. And I never really got to know Jake. But Ray had left, you know, due to his illness and went back to New Jersey. And Greg called me one day and said, "Hey, you want to come down and jam with us?" I'm like, "Are you kidding?
Right.
Sing for Badlands?" Of course. In those days, I could do that stuff pretty easy, High Wire and those tunes, and went down and jammed with them, and nothing ever came into fruition really. So after that, Greg said, "Let's do something." So I formed a band called Circle of Silence with him, and I was pretty good friends with Steve Plunkett from Autograph because he had written "Angel in Black" for the Bangalore Choir album. So I went over to Steve's and wrote a bunch of songs with him, and Greg contributed, and we did the first Circle of Silence album, incidentally, which will be released on Rocks Records again, limited vinyl. It's out right now, actually. That one and the second one, Suicide Candyman. I did that, those two albums, and then, you know, just to be honest, I grew completely, what the word is, confused about what I wanted to do. We had the L.A. riots, the Northridge earthquake, the Malibu fires, you know, grunge. I just packed up my car. I played the Roxy on the New Year's Eve of 1994, going right into 95, and that was my last gig. And I drove to Tennessee, and I bought a farm, and I retired.
Wow.
9 years, I walked away. Had enough. I'd had enough of California. I've had enough about music. I didn't know my identity as a singer. You know, I went from the top of the world with Accept in Bangalore to, you know, begging for shows. And I just didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel unless it was a train. So I just said, "I can't do this anymore. It's time for me to hang my hat up."
Definitely. Well, thank God it kind of came back around a little bit, and everybody can still play and put music out, because obviously the fans still want it. I mean, I'm always hoping for this new generation of hard rock and heavy metal. Hopefully we'll get it, but, you know, we'll have to hang on and see what happens.
Well, I think, you know, one good thing about the quarantine is, music, I mean, if you think about the 60s, what was going on then? Vietnam,
oof, crazy.
A total revolution inside the United States. A lot of music was kind of keeping people together. In Europe, we have the festivals, which, of course, are now on hold, but there's a great movement of music in Europe. I don't know what America's like anymore. I haven't lived there since 2014, but I know it's tough. But streaming has helped a little bit, you know, because people can't get out to purchase physical in the stores, but they can get it by post. Incidentally, I can't even mail my merchandise from home because our post system is closed now. Mm. But I was lucky enough with this album and Resilient Heart to kind of solidify myself, where people are going, wow, David Reese can still sing. He's got great, great songs. And I'm really lucky that way. And then my label, Alberto, did an amazing job of promoting this album. I mean, it's been fantastic with Dustin Hardman and all those guys working behind it. I'm completely satisfied. You know, and I'm blessed to still have Eat the Heat fans. You know, they write me nearly every day, new faces, new friends. I've got Eat the Heat, taking a photo with it, or bringing it to shows. Bangalore Choir is going to get re-released on vinyl shortly, again, a limited run. And my back catalog. I mean, I did something right. You know, I never quit. I quit for about 9 years, and then I got back in music in 2006 or 2007, and I said to myself, I'm going to give it 5 years, and if it doesn't work, I'm going to quit. And literally, at the end of the fifth year, I got a call to go work with Hans Zimmer in Bonfire. It was the weirdest thing. I was about to hang it up. Now I'm doing my thing, and I'm happy. And I'm happy there's guys like you out there that are promoting rock and roll, trying to keep keep it alive. Because I don't think there's going to be two ways this goes. It's either going to end the world that we knew, or it's going to open up new doors, and people are going to feel so good again that music will be re-inspired, you know?
Yeah, I definitely hope it's the latter. You talked about Bonfire. What was that like, being with those guys?
And a very unpleasant experience.
Was it?
And I wouldn't really want to elaborate on it. It was a lot of conflict. And that goes back to replacing a singer.
You know,
Klaus Lessmann is the voice of the Bonfire. And, Hans wanted to keep going and keep it moving. So, you know, we had done a kind of a thing called Easy Living for a while before that, and we got along pretty good in those days, and he said, well, I'm going to buy the name Bonfire. Klaus is going to retire, and would you be the singer? I said, okay. But things soon went south because of bad management and a lot of the same old story, rock and roll stories. Wasn't a very pleasant time for me, and I actually regret it, you know. great album. I did Glorious, and that's mm-hmm. one of the best-selling records they've done in years. So I'm proud of that. That album came out when Coverdale was doing the Purple album. And I remember watching the charts, and we were right behind them. We sold 5,000-6,000 copies in Europe. And that, for nowadays, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Actually, that album does sound really good. I was scanning that before our interview. A lot of us in America remember Bonfire from the Shocker soundtrack, Sword in the Stone, Paul Stanley Penn track. You must have played that live with those guys, right?
Oh, yeah. Every night. You put an album out called Glorious, and you've got Remember and songs like that. And you look at YouTube, and there's 250,000 views. The song did something. I mean, we did a lot of gigs. I mean, first year I played with them, I think we did 180 shows that year, and the next year was about 100. So, you know, we worked. We played a lot of gigs. A lot of festivals, you know.
Isn't it amazing, though? You touched on something about somebody bought, you know, the guitar, I think it was the guitarist that bought the name Bonfire. All these bands are like a brand, and everybody wants to hang on to that brand. That's why you see two versions of Great White and two versions of LA Guns and this version of this band or whatever, because these brands still sell and can still get festival gigs. I mean, it's still, there's still money there.
Exactly why. And it's sad because there's a lot of great new young bands. They don't have that name from 1985 or 88 that really deserve the attention. There's some amazing young bands. There's a band called Animal Drive with Dino singing. You know, mm-hmm. he's done work with Lynch. He's probably one of the greatest young rock singers coming out. You know, you've got Shinedown, which is a favorite in the house here with my wife. You've got Hailstorm, bands like that. They kind of have a name, but they haven't really broke because people hold on to the nostalgia. Like, except I think that Wolf is the only surviving member now in the band. It's the brand of the name. Bonfire still gets dates because of the name, when it's really not even Bonfire. I think there's been over 30 people that have been through that band.
Right.
Branding. You know, I mean, Judas Priest, those bands, you know, like you said earlier, those that magical time of 85, 86, 87, that stays with people. It's indelible, you know.
There's one new band. You'll have to, maybe you've heard of them, but you have to check them out. They're called Salem's Lot. You ever heard of those guys?
Yep.
Okay. His voice reminds me of a cross between yours and Blackie Lawless. And that was a band where, like, I kind of heard something, so I kept sticking with it and listening, and I really got into them. And it's sad because I'd say in the past 6 months or so, everything's social media's dead. There's no posts, nothing's going on. So it's like, did they give up? I mean, is that what happens to a lot of these bands? It's unfortunate because there's a lot of great bands out there.
I'm telling you that, like I said, that another thing too with music, now there's these young bands have really capitalized on social media. And what they do is they'll book a show and play for free or the door. And the club owner will say to you, well, can you guarantee 300 people? And you can't say yes. And then you'll say, well, I got this band out of blah, 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 Germany that will play here once a month, bring 250 of their friends, play for free. And just buy 10,000 euros with a beer and go completely ape shit, and you know, and they're great, you know. So it's just the pie has grown smaller.
Right.
People are vying for the same dates. If you're not filling rooms, you're not getting booked. But there's a lot of bands that are young that are going, listen, they're not going to pay us. We're going to play for free. We're going to be a band, and that's kind of a good thing. Like the old days, the hunger's back. You know, I mean, but there are really great bands that just go, you know what? I got a wife and kid at home. I've got a day job. I can't go to Europe for 10 days and play for free and pay for everything on my own, the visas, you know, the hotels. And they just go, you know, what are we doing? Nobody's buying our CD off online. So we go to a show, we sell 10 CDs in five shows. I mean, it's really tough, really tough. And if you're in it for the money now, you're wasting your time. I'm just going to be honest. I have a day job, and I'm a construction guy, and I do some farming, and I do it because I love it. I'm lucky to have a fan base, but without that backbone to keep me alive, I don't know how I would survive it.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I just do the podcasting and all the Twitter stuff just as a hobby, just for fun. I have a regular job as well. And but like you said, if you're not out there making music, people aren't out there promoting it, it is gonna crash. You know what I mean? So we've gotta try to keep this thing going.
Exactly. And I'm really opposed to these bands. I've seen some bands now trying to, you know, ask for donations because they lost shows. I mean, who do they think they are? The only bands who lost tours this year?
Right.
I lost 30 plus shows, good shows. But, you know, you got to use your head, you know, and not sell everything off and kind of plan because music is a liquid thing. It's like the economy. If people have disposable income, and I'll go back to this. I have a mountain of merchandise from the Cacophony of Souls tour. I'm not promoting it because I know it wouldn't be right for me to try to profit over people sitting at home because they've got nothing to do and try to make money. I'm going to wait this thing out. And I see other bands that are kind of milking it. And I think that's wrong. I don't think that's a healthy thing for the fans, especially the fans that have got no jobs and got kids to feed at home. Who have supported you for the last 20 years, and you're out there trying to, oh, we lost our tour and we're not going to make it. Well, you know, you ever use your hands? Do a day job. You're smart enough to build a band and survive. Go get a job. And then come back when things change and get back to work, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you
But
100%. There's so many, like right now, I mean, a lot of people are out of work. Food is hard to get a hold of in a lot of areas and stuff. Right now, you've just kind of got to buckle down and get in survival mode. And then once this all passes, then the shows will open back up. The merchandise can be sold. I think you're right. We just got to kind of let this pass.
yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I was raised to work and earn what I get. I'm grateful for that from my parents. My videos that are done by, I have a close-knit family of guys that I work with who are using, you know, my status, so to speak, to promote their artistic ventures and My brother just did this last one. It's a reflection, you know, Another Life, Another Time. It's about me and him as little boys, you know, when we were kids. And very touching video. He did it at home. And I've got another friend named Randashi who did Metal Voice and some other live videos for me. I got a good crowd of people around me that are, you know, they're pretty much panic stricken. They're sitting at home going, you know, I got all this time on my hands. I'm going to do a video or, you know, I clean the house for the 10th time this week. I can't even go to the store, all right? We can only go as one person, and you have to download a piece of paper and fill it out in case you're stopped to tell the police where you're going.
Wow.
So we can go to the pharmacy or we can go to the grocery store. That's how limited my life is, okay?
Crazy.
I can't fly. I can't do anything. And I had a job plan to go back to Montana. You know, when I started seeing these shows fall off, I thought, well, I'll just go back to Montana and work construction. Well, the oil fields are a big income thing for that state and, of course, ranching. But now the oil fields are closed, so the banks aren't loaning money to these young guys that are roughnecking to buy new homes. So it's killed that. So I'm basically at the mercy of wondering when this thing is going to open up, if it opens up, you know, during the summer when it's warm where I can go back to work. Or I have one show that's still alive, and that's December 5th. I've lost everything until December, and that's in Spain. And, you know, that's the 5th of December. Now, Spain is in a world of shit right now. I mean, it's bad there, the corona.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping it dies off and we can play the gig. But for 2021, I have no confirmations. I don't know anything. Yeah.
Well, David, what do you want to say to your fans that have been following you all these years?
The only thing that comes to mind is thank you. You know, let's stay the course together. I'll try to write the best records that I can. I have a great band. You know, Andrea Ginangeli on drums, Malte Frederick Burkert on bass, Andrea Susamil. Andy's got a new solo album coming out, by the way. He's got a new video out called Burning Man. Check it out on YouTube. Go to David Reese Official on Facebook, davidreeseofficial.info, to kind of keep up on what I'm doing. And if you bought the album, Cacophony of Souls, I love people to send me a message with a photo of them holding it, because I have a section called My Rock and Roll Family, and I post those photos as a thank you. And all I can say is thank you. I can't say it enough. And people like you, yeah, thank you very much. Keep the fire burning. Let's keep this thing going. And hopefully, I got a faith that we'll pull out of this.
Definitely, man. Well, hey, great conversation. I really appreciate your time. And I hope you stay well and stay healthy.
Same to you, my brother. Thank you very much.
That was awesome. David is so cool. Well, let me tell you all the different things we got coming up on the 80s Glam Metal Cast, all the episodes. Next, it's going to be Mark Evans from Heaven's Edge, Derek Davis from Babylon AD, Steve Blaze from Lillian Axe, and from Loudness, Yngwie Malmsteen, and Obsession, Mr. Mike Becerra. So I think it's a great idea for you to subscribe, because you don't want to miss a thing. I hate that song, but it just felt appropriate. Rock on!